Welcome back for episode 2 of Collaborative Vision. So for this episode, we were very fortunate. I had the chance to sit down with Dr. Samantha Slotnick, who is a behavioral optometrist based in New York. She was up at our clinic giving a weekend seminar discussing strabismus, which is eye turns, and amblyopia, which is one eye that has a stronger prescription than the other and the impacts related to that. She is, as we go through in the talk, she's a thought leader in this field, and in particular within this area of vision therapy, and having her share her wisdom for the weekend was absolutely fantastic. So she wears many hats. She's a researcher, she's a clinician, she's an author. She's involved with a wide variety of things related to behavioral optometry and many things outside of behavioral optometry, which we'll learn about here on today's episode. So thanks so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy our wide-ranging conversation with Dr. Samantha Slotnick.
I suppose we can kind of get rolling. I know we've been talking for a little while and a couple days, and you'll be able to hear from my intro some of the accolades of Dr. Samantha Slotnick, who we've been fortunate to have here at Okanagan Vision Therapy for the last few days, and thought leader in our profession for sure. Definitely a lot of mind-blowing revelations for a lot of us in attendance, so we really appreciate you coming.
Okay, are you talking now?
I'm talking now, yeah.
This is the podcast.
This is the podcast.
We're in.
We're going in. We're going 100%.
We're so, casting.
Yeah. This is we're casting. It's not live, I promise. But I do appreciate you taking the time to come out here. And I know we've had the chance to talk about things related to optometry, outside of optometry. You've got a lot of great insight in a variety of different fields. So I kind of wanted to start, we've been talking about eyes for the last couple of days.
We didn't talk about eyes.
We're talking about vision, I suppose.
A little bit on eyes, but not very much.
No. That's exactly correct. But I'd rather talk to you a little bit about, tell me what the role of dance has been in your life, totally outside of what we talked about.
Dance has been one of the most wonderful teachers to me, conceptually. As a person who, although being female, I am very androgynous in my makeup, and I take on a lot of masculinized roles in a lot of my walks of life. And if I have a mindset to do something, I do it. I'm undeterred most of the time. I take the lead and I don't wait for somebody else to take the lead. So I kind of sometimes, in terms of what I see in the field of vision therapy, and I can't really separate everything out, but you know, when I have ideas, I just follow them. And I've seen images of myself when there's something I want to do. It's kind of like there's a jungle and I just take a machete and I start making my own path. So what I'm seeing is I will take the lead wherever I need to go, and I'm undaunted in that. It's my makeup to be in that leader's role, and I don't necessarily care if someone's following or not. If I feel there's somewhere I need to go, I just go. So you take a person with a really strong mindset, and you introduce two other elements into that when you introduce the concept of dance. First, there is an organizing platform that's available to partnered dance. So, and I should say as a backdrop, I'm now dancing for about 11 years in salsa and other forms of Latin dance, but I was dancing and enjoying being part of a dancing or choreographed group when I was doing shows and theater and that sort of thing from a very early age. And I was also soloed out as being a person who could very quickly come up with or learn patterns and movements, and basically there'd be some part of visualizing the whole that I would be able to, who, where are we, and what comes together and what connects with what. I'd always sort of integrate through parts and be very quick to learn a series of moves and a choreography and do them as precisely as I learned them. Same with yoga and aerobics. I started aerobics when I was like 12 years old, and my mom was teaching and introduced me to it.
Right.
That's movement and rhythm and timing. And rhythm and music has been part of my backdrop for my entire life. the music was always on in my household. So it created a ground that people could share and have their figure within.
Right.
So
it's been a part of your life. It's not, I mean, it sounds like there's an element that it's an outlet, but it's also kind of woven into just every, you know, who you are, I suppose.
Yeah, it's very hard for me to separate out the things that I love and are and am drawn to and towards from, like, just how I see the world as a whole. So I take a very integrated view in my life. I take a very integrated view in the work that I do in helping people re-sculpt their systems so that they can take integrated views in their life and kind of put under the lens, what is it that doesn't fit in this big picture and what do I want to do about it? So, you know, to look in one's own mirror, essentially. And dance did that for me when I started learning partner's dance, because you had this commonality of feeling the rhythm, and especially with Latin rhythms, that you can really enjoy feeling these rhythms, and that there are rhythms and sub-rhythms, and there's this beautiful complexity to the music that emulates a lot of the things that I listened to when I was younger, including a lot of jazz and also Latin jazz growing up. So it was interestingly really a part of my household. Santana was often playing
right
in the background.
Yeah.
And a lot of more straight ahead jazz. So I listened to music and appreciated varieties of rhythms and was sensitive to different time signatures, and also had this background in performing and singing. So I had to be able to read different time signatures and feel them and know when to come in and start having visual motor integration around these different time signatures and what to recognize as, you know, when to pause and how much and for how long. And all of that's a very visceral experience. And I had such a strong relationship with the music that, again, for me as a leader in general, very hard for me to be a follower. So
and
what happens in partner dance is, you know, in Latin dance, there's a male role and there's a female role, and there's the lead and there's the follow. And it was the first place in my experience as a grown up where I learned how to let go, and that there was an incredible freedom in staying present to the moment. Because when I start predicting and moving into the next step, I'm cutting off other potentials. And so dance has helped me to learn to be incredibly present to the moment I'm in, and also to the bigger picture of, like, the several moments that make up the dance, and to the relationship that I have with a partner, to listen to how they're also feeling the music. And it's sort of like that theater thing where you can mirror one another and see when do you get into that funny in-between space where you both are sort of, you're not sure who's the lead and who's the follower, like pretending to be this imaginary mirror and somebody else mirroring you. In a dance relationship, some of that happens too, where you just sort of, well, there is a lead and there is a follower, but there's a moment when the seamlessness becomes a partnership. And I really enjoy that feeling of communion and connectedness with a partner. And you get these little, you know, the other piece of it that I enjoy, first the freedom that came with learning how to follow and let someone else lead.
Liberation.
Stepping out of my masculine role.
Right.
And letting myself have the experience of trusting another person, letting go, releasing. And then also that communion and connection that comes when you see a person. There's like every person brings their own sort of personality and energy into the dance relationship. And somewhere between 30 and 60 seconds in with a new partner, I usually see a sudden flash of recognition that they know that I really saw them in something that they did. Because I'll give them back stylistically some echo of something I've seen them do stylistically. So I'm mirroring their body movement in some way. So there's an enjoyment that I get as a female dancer that every time I dance with a new partner, each new partner gives me a new opportunity. It's not just about dancing to the music. It's not just doing new moves to the music, but rather dancing in the music, really being connected with the beat, there's the global beat, there's the subrhythms, it's the parts of your body you connect with the subrhythms, it's the subtle ways that you interpret the music, and sometimes even the phrases, whether they're musical phrases or literal phrases, but some little stylistic thing that a person will do, and I just kind of mirror it and give it back to them in another next verse or something. And that flash that you get from the person that says, oh, somebody saw me. You know, right. I'm not just filling a space and like a placeholder for a person to have an experience of doing a partner dance and having a partner so they can get their exercise.
Right.
There's more to it than getting exercise. In my opinion, there's a lot more to it. Some people go just to stretch themselves and get that experience of endorphin and release and moving to the music or with the music or even in the music. But if you're really hearing and listening and responding to your partner, both as a lead and as a follower, there's this room for you to see the uniqueness of one another and at the same time, cage it within this unity. So dance for me has been this liberating opportunity to let go, to step out of the role of leader and be a follower, to be present to the moment I'm in, to learn not to cut off those potentials by trying to guess where somebody's going to go.
Right. Yeah,
and that is very difficult for a person whose mind is so constantly churning and taking that next step and making the segue in the class by asking the question which speaks to the next slide that the speaker's yet to present. Those are things that were so common for me.
Yeah. And I feel one of the ways that I've maybe noticed it translates that you can speak on was even kind of observing you out. I mean, we just went for some wine tasting. We're in Kelowna, which is, you know, that's sort of what we're known for. And you have a really good way of developing quick rapport with people. Even the lady who was involved with pouring our wine, I felt like, you know, we were there for 5 minutes and you could tell that she was connected with you. You were asking the right question. You were making her feel safe and kind of mirroring what was, you know, what she was putting back. Do you get that from dance, or is that just in your DNA to, you know, fall into rapport with people?
Oh, chicken and egg question.
Yeah.
I don't know if I got it from dance. I've certainly developed it with dance. And, as you spoke to, I have other elements of exploration that I've worked on and consciously developed my awareness as a human being. And because I'm a sensitive observer, I've learned how to recognize subtleties in people. And I think that I've always had this innate, almost Pollyanna tendency to see the good in people, to see their potential. I'm really, really good at recognizing potential. And so, and we talked about that in the context of the course this weekend, envisioning where you see a person able to go, sometimes beyond, you know, they can go beyond that. Sometimes you see beyond what they think their potential is. But, you know, I see more than just what they're bringing to the table. I think there's qualitative things. I think there's spirit things and soul things that go with that. I tend to see a person's best side first. And I might be capable of seeing sometimes when they have more negative aspects, but I don't see them in exclusion of the positive aspects. So in some of our other conversations with components too, you know, I really recognize a person's best traits and tend to appreciate that light in them first. Mm-hmm. And I think that I enjoy that resonance. And it's not really just from visual seeing, but it is supported with a visual seeing.
Right.
There's a part of your visual process that sees beyond what is tangible and visible and maybe sees a little bit into that invisible.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's watching some subtle body language that a person has towards other people. Mm-hmm. Who's more open? Who's less open? You need this kind of little button press to get more open.
Right.
What can you do freely with a person?
Mm-hmm.
to help them feel more themselves, put them at ease. Versus, you know, you don't want to shut people down.
Right.
But isn't it wonderful when you just realize, like, you just barely have to touch and the light goes on and mm-hmm. the people want to help you. And even though there were two people offering to help us and one was more reserved, she was pretty comfortable coming yeah. out and taking pictures with us. And she was patient and quite lovely and appreciated the opportunity to give something. And, you know, it was a gift for her that we accepted her offer to support and not to be apologetic about taking her away from something, but to just say thank you to her for her time and care rather than, you know, feel like, oh, we're taking something from her. In fact, we gave her an opportunity to dance with us a little bit, right? You know, to change places and try different steps and moves out. And, mm-hmm. and we let her be a piece of that instead of just providing a service separately.
Right. So as someone who is a sensitive observer, so you're aware of the external world, you also are a leader and a thought leader. So you have, as you mentioned, an internal dialogue going on that, you know, moves you forward in that direction. What do you do to kind of move away from, I don't want to say noise, but do you have like a quiet place that you need in your life, or is observing the external world kind of your quiet place?
I like to have quiet.
Right. Okay.
My quiet place.
Right.
And I would say generally it's very noisy in my brain, not random noise, but there's I have a lot of streams of auditory processing going on, mm-hmm. often simultaneously. And also in the external world, I'm very capable of listening to multiple tracks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, just sitting here and being aware of the sound of the traffic outside.
Right.
But it's there. And so quiet is this really nice, luscious experience of gently removing the sensory component that is probably the hardest for me to suppress.
Gotcha.
And I like to be able to just kind of, there's a retreat. You know, I like to meditate and be able to just be within myself, be aware of some of those external noises, but not be generating them.
Right.
And I'd say that the main thing that I do is I don't like to pollute the variety, beauty, and sometimes simplicity, sometimes complexity of my own inner voices and soundtracks. Sometimes, you know, it's an internal dialogue that comes in musical phrases or instrumental phrases even that I usually find as humorous accents to the conversations that I may be having.
Right.
I hear these other little overtones that come from memory. There's something really nice to having just the quietude to be able to observe some of that or sometimes none of that.
Right. And you've referenced, you know, that internal dialogue, which we know is an important element of everyone's lives. It's mm-hmm. that person that's always with you. Mm-hmm. Maybe turning it a bit towards even the direction you've gone with your profession in behavioral optometry. And, you know, we know that you've moved originally in practicing in a variety of different ways. It kind of felt like you have this conviction and an understanding of the model of vision that you are comfortable with and that you believe in. Was it kind of getting to the point where there wouldn't be any other way that you could view vision? It would just be in conflict if you thought of it in maybe a more static way. Was there kind of a dialogue that you had with that?
I think there were a lot of dialogues. Writing is a dialogue that you have with yourself, and that the person who writes whatever thoughts are coming through you is a person who existed a moment before the person who then goes back and reads it. And so what happens is you get to time travel when you write something and then edit or read it or review it.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you an opportunity to take a thought that you have and externalize it to a tangible that you can then see and have a relationship to that's now outside of your body. When you have a thought that gets stuck in your mind but doesn't really ever get linearized enough to externalize it, to write a sentence, then it sometimes doesn't really fully form. You don't have the opportunity to poke at it and pull it apart and see if it stands the test.
Mm.
The gift of being able to write and to communicate is something that I have come to really appreciate, because it gives me a freedom of that internal conversation. It gives me the ability to talk with myself
mm-hmm.
across time, and to start to find out by kind of an iterative review, how do I feel now? So I look at something and that was written by the person I was a moment ago or an hour ago or a year ago. Mm-hmm. And now I review it and I start to tweak it and change it. But when the person that I now become is reviewing that in the future and is just in perfect agreement with it, you're moving in that iterative process towards a unity within oneself, and that is now standing the test of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so the visual process functions somehow independent of all of these constructs that we try to develop to describe it. And I've developed that model of vision through a stability within myself that even as I am getting presented with new experiences or opportunities to learn, whether it's a new domain or new data, it's been a little while since it's upended my model of vision. And so I feel like that's why I feel as comfortable as I do that this is how the visual process sort of works. And that I feel that I've now not only looked at it in a more integrated whole way, but looked at all of the minutiae within it and have continued to feel like things are hanging together. And writing the material that made up this RCS course
mm-hmm.
gave me an opportunity to have that dialogue, which I began with the help of mentors who also were reviewing and giving me a mindset and perspective outside myself, but carried on with just, I needed to agree with myself. I mentioned some primitive reflex work that I've added into my domain of how I treat people. It was such a beautiful gift to me to take this course from a very capable and well-versed teacher, and Caroline Hurst.
Mm-hmm.
I so enjoyed how she had taken her time putting things together and framing things. And there were a lot of parallels within her material that she was trying to draw. And really, it was so foreign when I sat down with the material at first from anything that I had explored. But what I found that made me so content was that at the end of the course, I integrated it without actually upending my model of vision. It all fit within an organized model of vision and just gave it more ornamentation and color. And it's just given me essentially the ability now to now take down what I already understood about how things develop, maybe starting from age 5 and going on. It really filled in gaps of questions I might have had about what might happen beforehand. It gave me a framework that I now had language to work with, and I just found it beautiful and elegant that it all just hung together.
Right.
So for me, that was a reinforcement in that inner dialogue that I was on the right track with how I put things together. It's not that I don't want to be challenged, but if it fits within the model, then you incorporate it. And if it clashes with the model, then you've got to readjust your model. So
yeah.
so that's kind of the process.
Yeah.
And recently, as I mentioned, I've been working on a chapter on strabismus diagnosis and treatment, and my job is the treatment component. And I'm sharing that as I work with another colleague that I haven't actually personally met. We've only dialogued. I like how she writes also. I like her her thoroughness, how she puts out ideas. Her name is Yinti,
mm-hmm.
and she's in Nova. Anyway, yeah. So she's double check me on that.
Yeah, no, that's
sure
okay.
She is.
Yeah.
Yeah, she is. But I haven't visited, so it doesn't always stick the same.
Right.
anyway, so I've been putting this together. It's not all completely finalized. But when I started writing, the stuff that flew through me and just into my pen and were out of my fingertips as I started typing, just kind of took its own form and shape, and just stepping back from it, I've maybe played with the verbiage, but it was just so elegantly simple. I felt like it's got to be right. I can't argue with this. It's just so elegantly simple. This is how I think things develop. This is how strabismus develops. This is how personalities start to emerge and use the data that they process and pay attention to sculpt their movement, their action, their choices. And this is how they sculpt themselves towards having new choices or more choices or fewer choices. This is why a person who's impulsive, for example, may be right so much of the time that they don't really learn the value of being a reflective observer, because it just takes extra time and they get to the same end point.
Yeah.
But a person who's generally impulsive may be a person who's a very astute, peripherally aware individual who quickly can solve problems by just looking at all the data simultaneously. It all drops in and here's the answer.
Right.
Well, if that's how you handle things, then why would you take the time to go back through all of the tiny little steps? It's not going to get you anywhere.
Yeah.
But I kind of like puzzles also. So I like to see them complete, and I like to also feel the process of putting them together. So I was kind of, talking about myself within the context of the course as having developed strabismus from a place of non-strabismus, but developing it, it was sort of in my makeup to be that peripherally aware, globally aware, very rapid visual problem solver and visualizer, and also within my makeup to tinker and build and know something intimately. So to go back over it and be reflective, it's probably a saving grace for me that helped me to hold things together. And but basically that I think is what problem solving in general is about.
Right.
It's like to understand the big picture and to be able to hypothesize and then work through it.
And this is something we talked about, not to go to go in a similar but slightly different direction. We know that you've been involved, obviously, in writing, in teaching, in academia, in just a huge facet of areas of education within our profession, and then also you run and manage a successful business, which takes a different skill set. So occasionally, I mean, they can all blend together. You had given kind of I wouldn't mind getting on audio. You had kind of talked a little bit about how you maybe mentally separate, the business versus, who you are as a clinician versus what you're doing. Do you mind going through your thought process there, or how you make all of those different aspects work for you? Because I don't find that it works for everyone. People might be more attuned to whether it be teaching or academia or business ownership. How do you make it all work?
Well, we talked a little bit about big picture and then getting the details worked out. We also talked about the other potentials of taking lots of baby steps, but but where are you going with those baby steps? You need to have an end goal in order for those baby steps to be truly useful. And I think that the research mindset that I had spent a lot of time enjoying was this ability to visualize a solution and hypothesize how does a person get there, and then start crafting a way to test the theory. Right. And so I like to have an idea or an end goal. And then I start thinking, well, how is this going to work and how do we modify things to get the answers that we want? And I'd say that the way that I approach my business has not been all that different. I have some very large global goals that I want to put into effect in terms of being able to offer services to people. I need people who need my help to know that I exist.
Right.
So that's a problem. And my solution is, what don't I know? What do I need to get help with? So to be willing to ask, to be willing to lead where I can lead, but follow where I need to follow some,
Gotcha.
So hiring or consulting with people who had gone through things before me, hiring people to dialogue with and help me mirror my thoughts to me and help me by expanding those ideas in a way that's consistent with me. I found a wonderful business coach who appreciated my holistic mindset in my life and in my work and in my approach to people. And I appreciated the challenges that I personally, on a human level, may experience in building and growing a practice, including how does one manage a team of people? How does one become a healthy and helpful employer? What kind of a leader do you want to be on your team? Do you want to lead by example, by inspiration? Do you want to help people feel like they have a role? Or do you want to be the person who tells people what to do, or, you know, delegates everything? You know, those are personal choices about how you want to see your business run. But there isn't really a right answer in general, but there may be an answer that feels right to you. And so from that researcher's perspective of, well, let's try it and see how it's going, but then let's also reevaluate and see what's not working. Every time we've encountered a challenge, a problem, a scenario, a patient, a scenario that we didn't enjoy on some level, you know, whether it's a communication issue, we assess it and bring it up. Not to point fingers, but amongst my teammates to dialogue about it and see what did we do, what could we have done differently, what can we do in the future so that we don't end up dealing with the problems we don't want to deal with. Not just like how do we want to deal with the problem the next time it comes up and just forego this patient, but, you know, what can we do or change qualitatively about the way that we operate? And so I think that the process of being a problem solver is the main thing that drew me to optometry as a whole. Right. It's the main reason why I wanted to be the researcher and mm-hmm. do the kind of work that I've done in research. And it's the helping people is something that I just inherently enjoy. So the primary care is something I'd like to be able to offer people, you know, to offer them primary care and support from a behavioral or holistic perspective, to not take off the table that people who need primary care might also appreciate that I'm looking at how their system responds under stress, and maybe they'd like to know about that. So then you have the question of how do I reach those people? How do I market to them? Who do I need to network with? What places do I need to put myself out on, you know, in a media place and right. a marketing place? And I had to start separating out that when I'm an optometrist, I'm working as an optometrist. But when I'm a business owner, I'm solving a very different kind of puzzle, and I'm working on the business. And so not working in the business, but separating out days or chunks of time in which I worked either in the business or on the business. And you can't necessarily keep intermingling them. And sooner or later, that aha moment showed up in my brain where I realized I am not my business. I am Samantha Slotnick. And the business has my name on it, and it also has a bunch of letters, but I don't really call myself by that name and a bunch of letters. I call myself Samantha or Mantha, or, you know, I have a dialogue with myself that I don't put all the titles or the letters. I don't think of myself as Doc. People think of me as Doc, but it's just one of the roles. I'm still a human being. Mm-hmm. So I had to separate myself from the entity that was my business. But the wonderful thing that happened the moment that I realized that I wasn't my business was that I created a space for my teammates to start taking their own ownership in our collective investment, which was our practice. And I got out of their way so they didn't actually feel like if they tried to take ownership or make suggestions that they wouldn't be received by the person who had to just make all decisions, but that they were free to offer them up to our team and throw these ideas out on our lunch table and see what does our collective think.
Right.
You know? So I learned how important it was for me to stop running things and to just step back and observe and separate my energy from the collective energy. And, mm-hmm. and it's different.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful thing to see it as a combination of contributions from all these different people. And that once I stepped out of the way, I also got the gift of all these people who started contributing in a more profound way. And really blended our own energies. It's like in the fabric, you can feel that there's a cohesiveness in our team. People remark on it, and my, you know, my patients will remark on it. And I just, this happened recently. I was out to dinner with my other half and my local area, and one of my patients happened to be walking into the same restaurant, this 8-year-old girl and her dad walking, and I saw the girl and immediately recognized her and the dad and called him my name, his name as well. He was caught off guard. I don't think he realized who I was.
Right.
Not right away.
Right.
But his daughter knew exactly who I was.
Right.
And it was this appreciation that, you know, sometimes you see a person and you don't know in what context you had met them. You recognize the face, but you can't face them. It was a beautiful thing for me that this girl that I've been treating for a couple of years now, since she was around 6, but she knew me instantly on site, out of context.
Right.
Dad didn't know me instantly on site, out of context, but I felt like that girl and I had a bond. I have always had this real deep respect and appreciation for this young lady as really a special little girl who is so aware of where her limits are. I think I respect that in her, that she knows who she is and she knows what she's allowing and what she isn't.
Right.
And when is enough enough?
Yeah.
You know, for a person who has trouble saying when enough is enough, because I'm always willing to put in that extra whenever it is, you know, I've got this driven tendency. But I think that things like that, seeing who is that person behind the proctor, you know, who is that person in the chair, even at 6 years old, and appreciating them, those are the gifts of the humanity of the profession. But that right through those eyes that you know, while I'm in the role of the observer and I'm looking at the person, just that appreciation that she saw me too.
Right.
And she had to see me for who I was, not as a role, but as a person, in order for her to recognize me so quickly. But her dad saw me as a role.
Gotcha.
Took a minute to see who was that person.
Yeah.
And she ended up coming in for a re-eval. I hadn't seen her in about 4 months or so, but she came in for a re-eval. A couple of weeks later, she wanted all these questions answered about the person that I was with. What, you know, I introduced them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was a human too. But
yeah,
it was like, it was just another appreciation of those ripples of, you know, it's important for us to be ourselves even within after practice, and to that while working in my space and being part of that practice, I'm so completely able to show a patient that I'm also this person, this individual, and that they can connect with that and see that outside.
Right.
And I feel like that's a feedback for me that I'm on the right track as a human being. And I don't know that I always make the most economically brilliant decisions in terms of operating a practice, but I'm very fulfilled in the work that I do. So it's, you know, it's certainly, at this point, it's successful. There's lots of places in which I'll need to grow, and I've envisioned those. And then you start visualizing and manifesting. That's how it goes, you know. You start to see what's the potential, and then you start to name those things that you want. And just stay a little bit patient and with that process, and things keep emerging in that direction. But part of that is the analytical part and problem solving. Then there's balance of see the big picture and be patient and recognize that you're providing a valuable service collectively. And if you have the want for it to grow and the universe has the need for it to grow, then it's sort of a fait accompli. And there is no other option other than success. There's just grades of how quickly you want to get there and how quickly you want to move.
Mm-hmm. And you've referenced, even in chats outside of this, you know, kind of what the energy you put out is often what's going to come back. How do you manage, let's say, communicating? So one of the great things is, you know, as you said, if you find that community of people who support what it is that you do, speak kindly of you and are supportive and have seen the benefit, you know, things continue to grow and to flourish. How do you manage communications, let's say, with someone who is in disagreement with your model of vision or your approach? Is it something where you look to engage, or do you more focus on, let's cultivate the intense few instead of the lukewarm many. Do you have a mindset around managing that type of an interaction?
What do you mean about being challenged on the model of vision? You mean from colleagues or from patients?
Maybe if it was a colleague who wasn't in support of vision therapy or an allied professional who wasn't in support, are you looking to engage with that person, or are you instead going to put all of your effort on the people who have chosen to trust themselves to your style of care or your approach and just sort of focus your efforts that way as opposed to trying to transition someone else's mind that maybe isn't viewing things the same way?
It's harder to flip a mindset, certainly, but it's much harder to flip a mindset from a place of going after the mindset.
Right, yeah.
And I think that thoughtful listening is a really healthy way to start fostering supportive relationship. Being willing to go first and refer somebody, perhaps, is another way. Getting a patient in common, and sometimes that means having a reasonable referral, creates an opportunity for dialogue and further discussion. I am not driven towards seeking out the problems at this point, because I find that the more you think about the problems, the more you find problems.
Right. So, very much agree. Yeah.
So I heard you say something like that over lunch today, actually. Don't even think about that. Don't think about all these problems. You don't have to worry about those details. And it's not just like release the details. It's more that I rather don't look for the problems. There's plenty of opportunities for learning. But I like to think about learning opportunities. It's hard to always gauge how far along you want to take a person. But the safest way to build agreement is to start with more general and straightforward statements that are global enough that a person may not take issue with it. As soon as you go into a specific with that a person really just doesn't know if they can trust, then you are dealing with the opportunity that that person can either accept or dismiss everything that you have to say, given whether they accept or dismiss that one premise.
Right.
But if you start to build a relationship around places of agreement and start with broad strokes, like commonalities that two people will appreciate about a person, you'll usually build allies rather than naysayers.
Right.
And so I found in a variety of fields, whether it's education, other allied professionals who work, whether it's psychology, neuropsychology, speech language pathology, physical therapy, you can start very quickly with a behavioral kind of assessment on who is this person. And in fact, from the patient standpoint as well, when I describe a person or a child to a parent in behavioral terms, and I nail it to like that. I've just told them a number of things that I've assessed about that person on a personality level that is not based on a conversation, but assessment of the visual process. And the parent recognizes that I really see their child. They don't have to, there's no inner conflict for them about whether or not I see their child, care about their child. It just falls into place that, okay, this person really knows my child, and I trust this person with my child because look at what she sees, look at what she observes, look at what she's hit the nail on without me actually bringing these things up. She just saw them in my kid, and whether it was in an eval or it was in a therapy session. And so that ability to perceive things, not just spit back, but to perceive and observe a person on a more global level, see their strengths, see their weaknesses or challenges, and report on it, instantly confers this agreement and alignment. And the truth is, if you're way off base on those statements that you're making, then you're probably making them for the wrong reasons, not because those are things that you really saw, but that you're trying to make an impression on a person. So you can't go and try to make an impression on a person. You can't set out to make an impression on a person and expect to do a healthy job of that. You need to just do your work. Do your job.
Right.
Be honest and open and sincere about what you see and what you think you can help or offer and what you think you can't, but where you might suggest that they get support. And honesty breeds trust. and trust breeds referrals. So,
that's a beautiful sentence. I love that. We'll put that up in the office here somewhere. No, I couldn't agree more. I think that's a really healthy perspective. And you're right. I mean, sometimes, you know, it can feel as though you're fabricating defenses for things that someone might not have even said or thinks. And if you get yourself in that loop, as opposed to actually being present and engaging and really trying to understand what their thought process is, I think you're absolutely right. That's kind of where trust sort of goes. And as you said, that breeds referrals. Do you, speaking sort of in terms of referrals and direction and where you kind of see things going for you, I mean, you've got a lot of really diverse interests in terms of, you mentioned writing, you know, research, you know, day-to-day, yeah, dance, practice management, all these kinds of things. Where can we expect to see you in the next 5-10 years? Do you have are you the type of person who has a trajectory? This is sort of, you know, this is my dream board and this is where I want to be. Or are you kind of more, let's take the 6 months and these are my goals?
No, I have a longer term trajectory that I think I had been putting out a longer term and recognizing that I would need to make some interim steps in order to get there. You know, first I'm building a practice that has people who can emulate what I do, and I'm helping to sculpt and cultivate skills in observation and training and communication that I can entrust the people that I care about to the hands of people who I believe are capable, and do more by continuing to help the profession as well. Once I've got more people who I feel are really those allied supports that work with me. And it starts with the therapists. And then I need to have a bigger space. And I need a space where I can have at least a second lane, right? Because, you know, New York is not the cheap place to have real estate. I need to grow first in order for me to go to a next space. I couldn't just be in this huge space without the population to support it. So, you know, it's a first office, having spent all this time doing all of the variety of things, primary care and research, and and alongside all of that, the writing and teaching. But the in terms of the practice and the behavioral practice, I want another lane, because that opens up the potential of having another colleague there. I'd love to help build a skilled associate, and I'd even more so love to have a residency program, and that would give me an opportunity to do some more in-house teaching.
Right.
It would give me more freedom to continue on a reduced clinical patient hour, but continue to do all of the other administrative and managerial things that the work requires. And, you know, there's a lot of back office work that we do. And people don't realize there's so much to do beyond the patient contact time. And for me, I think that's also, there's so much to do beyond the patient contact time for me to look myself in the mirror and feel like I'm doing the job I need to be doing. So, you know, I have very high standards for myself, higher than for most other people I encounter. I have very high standards for myself that they're not going away.
Right. Yeah, no, that's it.
So, like you said it, if I don't do it really well, I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
I'm willing to try things, but I'm not willing to put it out on a shingle, so to speak,
unless
I know that I'm skilled and accomplished at it. But, and I want to do things to that kind of degree, but I want to also help build a community of other people who are capable of doing that.
Right.
And so that's going to start with me having a larger space, to have a larger practice, potentially an associate and or resident. And so I'll also need to have more therapists. And I'll also need to have that freedom to start writing down more of my thoughts. So I know once I'm building to get there, then it's going to be able to continue to breathe so that I can do more of the, get these books out. I know I have these books that I need to start getting out, and, you know, maybe kind of find some sort of an unusual schedule and pattern where I have multiple days in a row that are really just intended for writing. almost a sabbatical would be.
Mm-hmm.
That would be an amazing gift, but right. I don't really want to be outside of the patient care either. So
right.
I don't know. There's a creative solution. I haven't found it yet, but I trust that it's there.
Yeah.
And so I see myself continuing to offer the clinical opportunities. I also feel, and I think we sort of touched on it tangentially in terms of educating other people in your circle, people that you encounter, other professionals that you may align with or have trouble aligning with at times, but build some rapport. And I think I have an important role in the community to raise awareness for the kind of support that we could provide. And at the same time, I feel that what we do so extraordinarily well in my space. I just want to see that more of that is emulated in other places. I'd right. love to be proud of many people within our profession as being confident enough to provide that kind of level of care. So I do see sort of a larger, longer arc of being more accomplished, having had more cases, and at that point being able to teach from a perspective to other professionals, inspire other professionals. So, you know, you asked earlier, like, can I see myself teaching the long term or in retirement phase?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. It's hard to imagine not doing what I do, though. It's so rewarding. It's every single day you have these incredible experiences that are transformative.
Is teaching for you, you're so fulfilled from the work that you're doing within your clinic. Do you, and you're obviously someone who feels connected to humanity, as we all do, is teaching kind of like your way of, I wish you could have what I'm having, and I'm happy to give you what I know, because I just feel like more people should have what I'm getting within a clinical setting. Is that? Yeah.
Yeah, that's the main.
Right.
There's this awareness that what we're doing is really extraordinary. And I know I'm not alone in what we're doing, but it's not necessarily a universal. There's no universal in vision therapy and behavioral work. One of the reasons I've enjoyed working with the Canadians is how beautifully supportive and collaborative I found the Canadian optometric community to be, that they really mutually care about growing and supporting one another and building a supportive foundation for one another to grow and extend and enhance skills. And wow, geographically, it's a huge country with so many underserved areas.
Right.
So there's this very heart-driven, heart-centered movement in vision therapy in Canada. And it's one of the reasons I keep showing up in Canada.
Right.
I really like the heart that is in that movement. And I think that in the States, there's a lot of different movements, but that there's been a development of what that visual process is about. And I feel like tendency towards polarizations and disagreements that I've seen or witnessed, and it's hard to keep coming into it with more of this open perspective when you feel like, well, is it this way or is it that way? Is there really an or? Can't there be an and?
I love that sentence. That's fantastic.
You know, is it this way or is it that way? Yes, could be the answer.
Right.
So I feel that patients don't always know what they're going to get. And that's hard because you don't always know who do you refer to. Mm-hmm. There's no platform of education that's a universal. There's no requirement of education that's a universal. There's no agreement on education. So I don't really know where it may go in the long run in terms of like on a political level within the States, but I feel like it's an enjoyable thing to watch right now what's happening in Canada, because it's starting from a cohesive place. So I have high hopes that there can be a maintenance of cohesive consciousness in the vision therapy community, and that there's also a benefit of starting at this point where there's so many masters who really teach some beautiful mm-hmm. cohesive concepts that you can start learning at a sophisticated level. Where are there healthy platforms from which to learn these ideas, from which to start this building point, and appreciate that there isn't only one way to get there, but that the masters are often in more agreement than disagreement.
Right.
So, you know, what can people do to sort of suspend closure on their concepts so that they leave themselves a little bit mutable as they start building their own model of vision? And that takes discipline. That's what the optometric schooling does for the doctorate. And, you know, you've got to suspend some closure. You need to learn about all the parts of the eye in order for you to start appreciating how it works as a unit. And you have to learn about all the parts of the body and different kinds of subsystems, histological and physiological and neurological and chemical and all these different kinds of reactions that are going on in different components of the body and where the same sorts of molecules find themselves in different components of the body and how they start echoing here and there. And there's just a beautiful concert of things that happens in the human body and that are emulated in the microcosm and in the macrocosm. And you spend 4 years really saying, okay, I'm willing to just learn this piece and feel like I can get a little closure here, but suspend full closure, right? Because until you've really learned the whole way around or really explored all the trees, you don't really know the forest yet, right? So you need to give yourself that suspension of closure that you're going to wait until you've got a certain critical mass of information that you can start building a hypothetical closure before you get to the place where you can say, okay, this is my theory on how it all works. You need you need to work with some hypotheses first and suspend it as closure and be willing to be surprised. Because the one thing I've learned is that it's really exciting to be in a place where you're working with real patients because they don't know what the rules are, so they don't follow them.
Right.
So I get surprised all the time, and I'm learning that, you know, sometimes I get a little surprised, and usually when I make up theories, let's call hypotheses, on why people do what they do, it's coming from an educated guess, but not really from knowing. Being surprised that, oh, well, why did this person do this? We had a nice little moment in the course where one of the attendees was, I was experimenting with her with the swirl, and I had her observing. She saw kind of an alternation between two different colors at first. We were trying to help her get fusion, and I suggested tapping on the right side of her temple to help her bring her attention over toward that side of her brain and that circuit. And she immediately realized, whoa, the color didn't do what I expected it to do. I thought if I pulled my attention over to the right side, it would go to the right side color, which was red. And instead, I shut that color off and I went to blue. So she had that aha moment. Boom, just like fell into place. I tried to do this. I expected this to happen. It didn't happen. Why didn't that happen? You know, like she knew that wasn't a match.
Yeah.
Why didn't that happen? Well, you don't like to be told what to do. I made these like behavioral assessments on her right away. Like, you don't like to be pushed into something. You're very sensitive. If somebody kind of pushes you in a direction before you're ready to go there, you're just going to close them off and you're going to go in the opposite direction until you're, you know, good and ready. But if you get a gentle invitation rather than a poking and prodding, maybe then you'll go. And we did a gentler version and there she went.
Yeah.
You know, so, it's not always so cut and dry that you do this and the other thing follows, but you can usually, when the other thing doesn't follow, you can usually kind of look at that big picture and say, well, what does that say about the person? Why didn't that follow?
Right. Well, it was a really great moment. There were many great moments in the course, and I know I can speak on behalf of all Canadians. We hope you continue to come and help us reach our hypothetical closure or work towards it. I would really, really just appreciate you taking time away from your practice and coming here and sharing with us and supporting the events. And yeah, just as you mentioned, it's not this or this. It could be this and this. And we love that so many of the thought leaders like yourself have been coming up and teaching us what has been helpful to them. If there's people listening here, I don't want to take too much more of your time because I know you still need to eat dinner. And if people listening would like to learn, I'm sure they will, but where could people learn more about you? Where can they find you? Where would you direct them to?
I do have a website, drslotnick.com. So it's Dr. Slotnick is S like Sam, L-O-T, and like Nancy, I-C-K.
And we'll include that in the notes too. So,
okay.
Yeah.
That's a good place to start. I have a blog that's connected with that. If you click on the blog, you'll be taken to an offsite. But if you can also go directly there with drslotnikblog.com. I invariably have these ideas and notions that I start to throw out onto my canvas, as it were, having little conversations with myself, right?
Yeah.
sometimes I make them audible to the audience at large. I have a website. I'm sorry. In addition to the website, I have the Facebook site, and I do have ideas that I post there, and I have some team members who also post there. On Facebook.com/Dr. Slotnik, if you were going to do a quick check, that's an easy way to find our page, and that it gives a place to dialogue a bit. And I'm a very avid supporter of some of the Facebook community groups that look at vision therapy. I like to be a participating member because I feel that there are a lot of patients with questions that are not getting answers. And so as time allows and as the, as the movement of my hands dictates, like, where do I respond? Because I can't respond to everything.
Right.
But sometimes I just feel driven towards responding. And usually I find that it's helpful when I do. And I have had to let go of some of the feelings of frustration that I can't respond to everything. But, we can't do all of it, or we can all do our parts. There are a couple of worthwhile groups. Vision Therapy Parents Unite is an amazing supportive community of parents, therapists, doctors, patients, all people who are appreciating the role that vision therapy has in helping their children or adults as well to reshape their lives into the world they wish to envision for themselves, and to empower them to interact with their world in a more visually directed and guided mode of action, to feel more successful, more self-confident, more capable of problem solving and thinking freely for oneself, seeking information independently and finding it on one's own. Those are the rewards of building humanity, right? You know, it's not to me about helping people get their eyes on point. That's right. Not what I do. I think I help people get their souls on point. recognize where are the gaps between what they want to see for themselves and where they are. And I envision a bridge to help them get there. And some of that we do hands-on in the clinic, and some of that in a conversation. I have some other highfalutin ideas about ways that I can try to provide some sort of webinars or something that patient demands kind of wish for ways to communicate. But other dialogues I have about, I don't want to take away from doing quality vision therapy. So, doing some perceptual work that would be helpful. I'm not sure how to couch it yet, or as educational or coaching. But, in our conversation, you see that there's this philosophical bit that underlies all the work and my vantage point. Right.
Yeah.
So I feel like I'm trained as a healer who's specialized in the visual process, and as well as the health management of the eyes. But that's so ancillary to me compared to, really helping people through the most impactful pathway of our senses. And I feel like many people find that the time that they spend in collaboration with me is that the richness of the dialogue and how it resonates for them in their lives. That's really why I do what I do. And it's a beautiful vehicle within which to work. And so I'd like to be able to offer that to whatever extent the calling continue to show up. They're out there. Right now there's a lot more one-by-ones, but there's a healthy dose of philosophy and perspective and internal organization that I try to help my patients with, and I try to emulate, and I try to model. That's another model of vision.
Yeah.
A model of vision.
There we go. It's beautiful. No, I think you've done a really great job, as you mentioned, I think people who listen to this or who have spent any time with you, they can kind of feel that you're a very fulfilled individual. And as a teacher, I think that that's beautiful because people will see you and say, I kind of want to download some more of that into my practice, into my life. And so I just really wanted to, again, thank you for coming up here and sharing, you know, your energy and sharing your teachings. And I'm sure we'll stay in contact and see you at lots of different events.
Oh, I'll be there.
You'll be there, which is fantastic. And yeah. So anyone who's listening who hasn't had the opportunity to listen to Dr. Slotnick lecture, I would really encourage you to get out and do that through the OEP organization, through COVD, through just any opportunity you get to listen to her speak, I would say is well worth your time. So thank you so much for spending a little bit of time in the evening.
Thank you for that. And I don't always have one on the docket, mm-hmm. but we don't always know where people want to have me come out. So
right.
If it's in the States, certainly OEP is one of the anchor places, but if you let me know that there's interest, I can start trying to pull things together to suggest this location in one place or another. But also I've had many private practices ask me to come and work with their team. Right. And it's another thing that I enjoy doing. So, yeah. You know, as you discuss, the teaching is more about sharing this vantage point that enriches people's ability to serve as supports for the people who find their way to them. So being able to teach people like you all who are fully engaged is such a blessing. You know, so whether I'm working in the RCS modality or kind of crafting something that takes on this global perspective in whichever of the domains need a little bit more help, I'm pretty quick on my feet to work on helping people where they need the support and providing some opportunities for global learning that mm-hmm. apply to the subsets, but also to the global. There's nothing that we do that we work on that's really not applicable to everyone.
Right.
And so I mean, it took me a while to realize that it's not this activity for this and that activity for that and this one for this kind of person, but really every one of these arrangements is a learning opportunity. And the same goes for the courses, you know, they become these little arrangements that are learning opportunities that I just really enjoy doing. So don't be shy about asking.
No, please, you will absolutely not regret it. As I said, our team is fired up and we're really excited to implement a lot of the things we learned this weekend. So wonderful. I'm going to, as I mentioned, I'll let you kind of get some food. I appreciate you staying late. It's late on a Sunday night. And I appreciate you letting us turn the mic on and have a little conversation. And as I mentioned, I'm sure we'll continue to stay in touch. And I hope you enjoy the rest of your time in Kelowna.
Thank you. And thank you for the tours.
No problem.